On this episode of the Fear Beyond podcast, I have the pleasure of introducing Petra Pumer. She's a Santa Barbara practitioner of the Mindful Eating Institute. She helps people overcome and deal with their anxious eating. She doesn't necessarily work with people that have eating disorders per se, but she helps people come to terms with anxious eating by helping them deal with whatever is creating the need to use food as a way of attaining comfort. Really enjoyed talking with Petra. She's very smart and insightful and kind. Hope you enjoy this episode. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming Petra Pumer into my office. She runs the Mindful Eating Institute, and it's an institute in Santa Barbara designed to help people overcome emotional eating.
Yes.
So, Petra, I really appreciate you coming. I've not done an episode of my podcast about eating and its relationship to trauma. So I'm really happy that you're here. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and we'll kind of go from there?
Yes. I was born and raised in Germany and got my master's degree in clinical psychology at the University of Hamburg in the north. Worked as a therapist near Munich for a while, switched over to human resources. And after laying off a bunch of employees, I was let go as well, which was pretty upsetting at the time. However, it enabled me to rethink my life's choices, and I immigrated to Santa Barbara, where I had lived before as a younger woman.
Oh, okay.
So I came here with two bags in 94, and I'm still here.
That's great. So you were born in Germany.
Yes.
And which part of Germany were you born?
I was born near Cologne in the Rhine River area.
Okay.
And grew up in a working class family with people who had survived World War II. And that's a whole different topic we could maybe do on a podcast, that countries carry trauma too. And so I know all about intergenerational trauma.
Right.
And which is a segue into trauma and disordered eating or using alcohol to numb and take the edge off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that something that you noticed as a kid growing up there?
Yes. My father drank.
Okay.
He was fighting at the Russian front as a very young man, survived. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you
right.
today.
Right. That makes
and
sense.
My mother's school got bombed when she was a teenager. And so there was a lot of trauma. And people in my hometown with a missing limb. My father had wounds in his arm. And so there was a lot of, and when we walked in the forest, I would see holes where the bombs had struck.
Wow.
So it was omnipresent, but that's all I knew. And a lot of alcoholism and cigarette smoking in our home.
Okay. And do you have siblings or are you an only child?
Well, that's another podcast, I guess. I thought I didn't have any. Later, after my mom passed, it was revealed to me by my aunt that apparently my father was married before the war and had a boy.
Oh.
And had another child with another woman all before he met my mom. So they're somewhere half siblings in the world. I haven't found them yet.
Oh, you haven't found them?
No.
And did your mom not know about them?
No, they all knew. They just protected me.
They just didn't tell you.
Yeah, they didn't tell me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about what it was like to grow up during that period of time.
I was raised by my parents as the golden child. They wanted one girl. She gets everything. I'm the only one in our family who went to university. I was blessed to have had teachers who taught me how to think dialectically. We were introduced to literature that made us question history, made us question dogma. So I'm very fortunate I was raised in that environment, and I always was different than my other family members. I started working for an airline at age 18 and traveled the world, and I discovered Santa Barbara in 1980, and my soul knew this is my true home.
Wow.
Right away. It was an instantaneous, this is home. So I flew home without a doubt, and I said to my parents, I'm going back there right away. And I lived on Miramar Beach for a year, and waitressed, traveled around, and in 82, I went back home to Germany to get my education. Because I have a pretty good brain that I wanted to put to good use.
Okay. You got your PhD.
No, master's.
Master's, okay.
Master's degree in psychology. I always was interested as a super sensitive child. And now I know I'm an intuitive empath.
Okay.
I wanted to understand human behavior.
Okay.
And
that was something you were curious about as a child?
Yes. Wow. I was teased a lot. I mean, my teenage years were just horrible. I hated them, and there was no support. You know, my parents were not able to nurture or protect me emotionally. They didn't know how to.
Okay.
And that leads me to how I work now. We can talk about this later, to help reparent yourself and give yourself what wasn't given to you. It's a huge part of my treatment model.
Good. That sounds necessary and important, that's for sure.
Yes.
And did you get teased for being a sensitive person? Is that why you were...
No, my looks. I was a very athletic girl, like a late bloomer. And the other girls, I was in track and field when we were showering. They just laughed about my body, my physical appearance. That was very, very hurtful.
Yeah,
horrible.
It doesn't sound very good.
No. And rough childhood, really.
Sounds like it.
I got food and shelter and love, but grew up basically raising myself emotionally. There was no support.
Okay.
And no boundaries either. So I was this free spirit.
when you say no boundaries, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
What that means is I was 16 and had met a guy, a pen pal, a French guy, and said to my parents, I want to go to Paris. And I was 16.
Wow.
They let me go.
Without a thought?
Yes.
Wow, that's kind of bold, actually, to send a 16-year-old.
It's crazy. And something really bad happened there. So
so it didn't turn out so well.
No.
Okay.
And so I come across the phenomenon in my work when clients find me for weight loss reasons, that many of them, I'd say over 90% of my clients or patients, didn't have safe attachment, good mothering, nurturing, a sense of feeling safe, seen and heard. In many cases, that was missing.
So that all of that sounds familiar to you as a person.
Yes.
So it makes sense that you would understand it very readily and easily when people come to see you with those kinds of backgrounds.
Yes. And I know that healing is possible. I was exposed to trauma, emotional neglect, violent abuse, and took me many, many years to heal in layers. You know, there are segments you heal and then you feel you're done and then you keep going and there's another layer. And it took me 60 years. When I turned 60, almost 5 years ago, I drove along the bird refuge and I thought, wow, it took me this long to come home to myself.
Wow.
It was a beautiful feeling to know.
Oh, I can imagine.
I'm home. I really love myself, not in a TikTok, Instagram kind of way, you know, more like
yeah.
Really, really taking care of myself emotionally without leaning on external sources. That's what I teach my clients is if you have no journal available, nobody to call, you still have yourself. So I help them strengthen their inner resources. And
okay.
That takes time.
Of course it does.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help your clients even know that they have inner resources to begin with, because a lot of people don't really know that they have something to draw on the inside.
Yes, we all do. And in my 4-page intake form, which is really not about weight and food, it's more about assessing which parts of your life are going well. I use the life balance wheel where people rate various areas of their life. Then I have a question in there. What positive changes have you manifested in your life? What inner resources can you draw on? So it's a positive psychology approach.
Okay.
We all have inner strengths. And I just facilitate them strengthening what's already inside of them.
A lot of people, again, don't know that that lives inside of them.
Yes.
So how do you get them to recognize their resources?
When they share what they have accomplished in their lives.
Okay.
And take for granted, for example, you know, I've raised 2 daughters. Yes, great.
Yeah.
You know, I survived abuse. Great. I invite my clients to journal each night about 3 things they're grateful for, 3 things that they're proud of, which is really important, and also share their favorite moment of the day. Write that down.
Okay.
But what are you proud of? Could be, I did today. Good job.
Okay. Do the people that come to see you know that they have emotional issues related to their relationship to food, or is that something that you help them discover?
It's also a great question. I help them discover that.
Okay.
Yes. Clients call me and say, Petra, I don't have another diet in me. And I said, I understand.
I'm sure you hear that all the time.
Yes. And I taught weight loss at Sansum many years ago.
Okay.
And would never work the same way again. It was a behavior change model with prepackaged foods. And it helped our patients lose weight. But then life took over later and emotional eating was not addressed. So when I do my initial interview with clients to see if we're a good match, I ask, what is your heart hungry for? What are you soothing? And have you had emotional neglect, abuse, or even physical abuse growing up? And in 90% of the cases, people say yes.
And was that part of your experience with food as a result of the trauma you suffered?
No, I didn't go that route,
Okay. Interestingly
enough.
Yeah.
But I had other issues that I needed to heal. My unhealthy relationships with men, looking to fill myself up. And I've been single for 8 years for that reason, I think, because I'm basically dating myself at the moment. So the point is having compassion for the part that was left alone as a child.
Right.
I invite my clients, I sometimes say, if I gave you a foster child for 3 months, what tone of voice would you use? What would you feed him or her? How would you support, strengthen, and comfort that kid? And they all know how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we were held accountable for how we talk to ourselves, we'd be in jail for assault because we would never let anybody talk to us the way we talk to ourselves.
I know. It's sad.
It is really sad, but somehow we think it's okay if it's coming from inside, whereas coming from the outside, you would never tolerate that kind of behavior.
Never know. So changing that inner dialogue, Dana, is very, very critical. I'm bringing in a lot of self-compassion into my work because I feel Dr. Kristen Neff's research on self-compassion, mindful self-compassion, is really the heart of my treatment model. Treating ourselves the way we would treat a loved one or a child in need.
Okay.
If there's an anxious child who's scared to go to school, would we just say, just have more chips and another glass of wine? No, probably not.
Right.
In most cases, not. We would say, honey, come here, sit with me.
Right. So what about the idea that a lot of people don't believe they deserve the compassion that you're talking about? Because
excellent question.
You know, I've noticed that, you know, it's one thing to encourage people to be compassionate, but a lot of times I get a sort of a glassy-eyed look from people. They know what that means, but they certainly don't believe they deserve
100%. I'm working with a client right now. She was referred to me by a physician. Highly aware, emotionally intelligent, and her biggest obstacle is, well, I don't deserve to feel good about myself. So right. We have to take that deep dive and going, we have to go to the core need, which is strengthening the belief, I deserve to be healthy. I deserve to live a vibrant, joyful life. That takes a long time to reprogram. Yes. It just doesn't go away in 3 months.
That's for sure. Well, and it also takes an enormous amount of courage.
I know. It's interesting you bringing up all the keywords I used in the session with the client last week. I said to her, you are so brave and courageous. And she said, how is that brave? So we discussed that.
Yeah.
I believe it takes a lot of courage to take that deeper dive, you know, instead of maybe getting an Ozempic injection, right. which helps you temporarily some weight. And one analogy I want to give is I'm working with a local dentist, and he also is very sharp and emotionally aware. And when people try a diet, another diet and another diet, and I understand that, the longing to feel lighter physically and emotionally. But if we don't go to the root cause, it's like doing fillings over and over again, and we know we actually need a bridge or we need a root canal.
Right.
So it's a deep dive, and working with me takes courage. And since I know what it takes to go there, I make people feel safe, Dana. That is one of my strengths.
Is helping people feel safe.
Yes.
Okay, because my guess would be, and again, I don't do the kind of work that you do, but most people, when they go to solve an eating issue, as an example, it's hard for a lot of people to imagine that it's related to anything other than a healthy, unhealthy relationship to food.
Yes.
Right? So are people caught by surprise sometimes when you're not just teaching them how to manage their food, but actually teaching them how to love themselves and be more connected to themselves?
Actually, there is not a lot of surprise. It's as if they had always known.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe they knew, but didn't know how to get there.
Oh, okay.
And
so you can provide a roadmap in that direction?
Yes. Every client, of course, every person is unique. However, there are some principles I use. I teach all my clients to meditate.
Okay.
I have little accountability check-ins, and it's so beautiful to get those emojis from my client for, I carved out 3 minutes just time for me, or I carved out 1 minute to meditate, and I'm now taking a ritualistic shower after a stressful work day. So I invite them to send me little emojis so I know it's done.
Okay.
And sometimes that makes a big difference. You know, not just 1 hour a week with me, but in between session support is also important.
Well, I think accountability is really important because it's so easy to say, I'll do it tomorrow.
Yes.
Or I'll do it later.
So with accountability, I have to be very careful. I was an assertive, tough weight loss coach in my old life.
Okay.
I'm no longer that person because I truly believe none of us need more discipline. We need more nurturing.
Right.
So I have to be careful if I give assignments that doesn't, I have to be mindful that it doesn't trigger this, oh, it's structure. I need to do this. And what if I don't journal? Will Petra be mad? No.
Right.
It's super important to explore the inner, the internal obstacles and also external obstacles.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sure that during your tough days, when you were, you know, being a taskmaster, that you didn't realize that you were actually shaming people into submission.
I did. Well, I was still kind.
Yeah.
It was the structure of the program, and I would stand by the scale with a clipboard weighing my poor patients in.
Yeah.
Now, if somebody asks me, should I weigh?
Right.
I say, well, can you step on the scale, and whatever number you see, you can love yourself throughout the whole process. If they're not ready, I said, don't weigh.
Right, right.
And
yeah, I was not insinuating you were purposely doing it. It's just that I know that those programs work in a very sort of, can not be harsh, but certainly structured in a really rigid way.
And you know, we helped people. However, what I do now is so much more heart-centered.
Right.
And heartfelt and more compassionate.
Right.
And I did the best I could then. That's a long time ago.
Sure.
And started my business because I realized emotional eating is a very, if not the most important component for finding peace with food.
Okay. And are there a variety of reasons emotionally why people turn to food, mm-hmm. like
yes.
That you see kind of over and
yes.
over again?
I think number one is stress.
Stress.
Anxiety, boredom, loneliness. And I have clients who say, I eat for any reason. Give me a reason and I eat.
Okay.
So here's the difference. When I taught smoking cessation for 6 years.
Oh,
so
okay.
Nicotine addiction is a powerful addiction.
Oh, absolutely.
So we don't need to smoke. We don't need to drink, but we need to eat. So it's a little bit more
it's
involved.
It's more difficult, yeah.
It's more difficult. However, the principles are the same. If somebody numbs out with food and checks out with food, that deserves compassion and understanding. If a person can only pause for a moment, say, hold on a second, put your hand on your heart and say, honey, what's going on? What are you needing right now? As if they were asking a precious child. And if they can delay, then emotional eating over time will diminish. Now, it really takes a while.
Yeah.
You can't just give up that crutch if it has supported you emotionally for 10, 20, 30 years. So I don't rip off that Band-Aid, but I help people create new life-affirming rituals.
Okay. You know, I think that what you're talking about is extremely important because people say to me all the time, you know, I just want to stop doing this or I want to start doing this.
Yes. And
my response is always, especially if you want to change a habit or whatever, you can't just give it up without replacing it with something else. Because we all need something to hold on to
100%.
That helps us feel like we have some amount of control, I guess, in a certain way, over our destiny. Because as humans, it's really hard to feel out of control.
And tolerating pain and discomfort can be mastered. It's not easy, but having a difficult emotion run through,
okay.
I've experienced it. I have a lot of fear around medical results and I can almost go into a state of like intense anxiety. And one time I said, enough, sit with it.
Okay.
And I dared to sit with it. And the fear and the anxiety worked itself through me and then left. So I know it's not going to kill us, whatever we're feeling. And a client said this to me in a group session. Feelings won't kill us.
Right.
So teaching somebody to navigate difficult emotions, I wish they taught that in school. You know?
I wish they understood that in school.
Yes. And I lean a lot on Buddhist thinking, like leaning into what is important rather than fighting our current reality and embracing that suffering is part of life.
Right.
Is also important. So how we frame our condition, what stories we're telling ourselves. So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is part of my training. I weave all that in.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Yes. If somebody says, oh, I'll never get there. That's obviously not a helpful thought.
Right.
We cannot not think a thought. It's already there, but we can label it as useful and beneficial or not.
Okay.
And learning how to say, no, that's not serving me, trashing that thought and replacing it. Of course I can get there. I trust the journey. And it doesn't do the trick all around, but it's one tool in the toolbox.
Right.
Sometimes you're not interested in cognitive restructuring. You just want to get that burger and the glass of wine. And building in that mindful pause is so critical. Whoever is listening right now, if you can build in that moment of taking a break before acting, sounds very easy, but it's hard to do.
Well, especially when you're feeling anxious or frightened, or lonely, or all the different feelings that you're talking about, those are very powerful motivators.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And like I said, if food was a trusted friend and comforter and soother for a lifetime, it just can't be ripped away from somebody.
Right.
And most clients share with me that their relationship or struggle with weight and food started at age 7 or 8.
Really? Mm-hmm. And what is it about that age that you think begins that?
They were told that they were chubby.
Oh, okay.
I have them pull out photos of themselves at that age. Children look pretty normal to me. So it's belief systems in a family. Also, I think one of the worst case studies, the saddest, was a client of mine who couldn't go to bed or to sleep without eating cereal late at night.
Okay.
So we, again, went back to her past, took a deeper dive. When she was a little girl, her parents had fist fights in the kitchen, and the little girl was so scared, and all she could think of is, if I eat cereal, I make myself feel safe.
Oh, okay.
So later in life, of course, she and I addressed this. She was able to let go of that over time and learned how to make herself feel safe by putting her hands on her heart and saying, I am safe. And she said, no, I want to bring in a wider circle. My family is safe. My friends are safe. And that ritual went to the core need,
okay,
which was, when I feel unsafe, I eat.
Right.
Makes total sense.
It does, especially if you start eating cereal as a young person and filled with sugar and fat, and, you know, it's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it does the job. I mean, I remember as a little kid, I ate tons of cereal. That was my major diet.
Right.
Because, you know.
Yes. So clients share traumatic experiences with me. You know how we say, oh, there is no boogeyman under the bed. Well, in one case, the boogeyman was under my client's bed, and it was her dad.
Oh, okay.
So he was not well. He was mentally ill, and he scared the little girl, and then she developed a pattern of disordered eating. And here's a disclaimer. I do not work with eating disorders.
Okay.
Like bulimia nervosa or anorexia. Those are, I feel they need a team of practitioners, and I refer them to Alsana Treatment Center or specialized therapists in town.
Oh, okay.
I help with yo-yo dieting and emotional eating, which is still disordered eating, but not as severe and life-threatening.
Right. Yeah, anorexia and bulimia can be life-threatening.
I think so,
sure.
Yes. Yeah. It's I don't feel comfortable treating that. I know that's not my expertise. But what I do now, like a colleague of mine said, Petra, it's not just your passion, it's your calling. And that is true.
Okay.
I want my clients to become the person they needed the most to remother and reparent themselves.
Okay.
That is the goal for every client I work with.
And if somebody asks you why that's necessary, how do you explain the necessity of it? Because I'm assuming people don't they're not just going to accept everything you say at face value. They want to know why. Why? How is this going to help me? What's this going to do for me?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I don't spring that whole concept on in the first session.
No,
it's
a development
of trust.
Okay.
And understanding that in order to navigate a difficult feeling, and if you were never taught to self-soothe
right.
in a healthy way,
yeah,
that's what good parenting is, I think, is to help a child feel safe even when they're stressed and anxious. And, oh, well, I got you. You're fine. So my clients understand the concept of reparenting.
Okay.
One person said, I don't want to call it remothering. I don't want to think about my mother. Can we call it reparenting?
Okay.
Good. So I feel, there is a deep understanding.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So that's part of it's a really important part of the concept that you...
It's the heart of the treatment model. It's remothering, protecting the inner little child, and having your own back. Are you familiar with Louis Hay's mirror work?
No.
Where you look in the mirror and you hold your face and you say, honey, I've got you. I really, really, really love you.
Oh, okay.
These are little tools I suggest, and clients can try them on. I myself, when I'm really upset, I do that.
Okay.
I look in the mirror and said, you don't worry. I've got you.
Okay. Does it help?
Yes.
Yeah.
It does.
Okay. And a lot of people that I've talked to that have struggled with their weight, mm-hmm. and it's obviously not something I do as a specialization, but a lot of the people that I've seen that have to develop a relationship with food have sexual abuse in their background.
Yes.
And part of what I've noticed is that when a person starts to lose weight under these circumstances, it becomes, you would think they would feel good and happy about that because they're achieving their goal mm-hmm. of losing weight.
Yes.
But the anxiety level seems to increase with the amount of weight loss. And that's very confusing for people sometimes. And part of what I have noticed is that in our society, the less weight you have, the more sexual attention that you get.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people don't realize that consciously that people are starting to look at them. People say, hey, you look great. And that's a sort of a neutral way of giving somebody praise. Mm-hmm. But I think that people start to sense sexual interest. And that's the thing that triggers their anxiety and their need to gain the weight back again.
Safer.
Because they start feeling really afraid because I'm not sure our bodies are able to distinguish between healthy and unhealthy sexual attention until you deal with the trauma.
True.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes 100% sense. It makes me think of a client who was in a marriage and she wasn't that overweight, but she wanted to lose some weight. And with that came a little bit of concern, but well, then other men can look at me.
Right.
And I get the attention that I seek. And how do we navigate that?
Right.
So there's so many layers.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah, if I'm thinner, men will look at me. That's not a good thing.
Right.
So again, coming back to how can I make myself feel safe in my own body is so critical.
Right. I had the hardest experience when my wife and I were in our late 20s. We went to the South Pacific and we were in Fiji and we went to a restaurant. My wife is a very tall, really thin person. Mm-hmm. And we were in the restaurant having breakfast and she went up to use the restroom and the waiter came up to me and he said to me, is your wife ill? And I said, not that I'm aware of. What are you talking about? Well, do you not feed her?
Oh my gosh.
I said, I don't really understand why you're asking me this question. First of all, my wife is in charge of feeding herself.
Right.
She's an adult and knows when she's hungry and when not. And she said, well, in our world, if you allow a woman to be that thin, it's a sign that you don't have any money.
Oh.
And that you're not taking proper care of your wife because we value women that are large. And so your wife is very frightening to look at. And I just thought it was the strangest concept because I was
the cultural thing.
Obviously. Yeah, totally cultural thing. And when my wife came back, I told her what happened. She kind of rolled her eyes. But it was probably the first time I realized how culturally specific our bodies look, especially women.
It's interesting.
Nobody cared whether I was overweight or not.
Yeah.
It was her that got the focus.
Talking about being thin, I'm at a weight now that to me is my best and healthiest weight.
Okay.
When I worked at Samsung, I weighed at least 15 pounds less. And people said, Petra, you look very thin.
Oh.
And I guess this whole diet mentality had an effect on me. And I was dating a West African guy at the time. And
okay.
He also thought, oh, like, my God, you're too thin. Like your skin and bones.
Right.
And I want to speak to what we, in our culture, we have to be mindful when we give a compliment. Have you lost weight? You look great. Not a good idea. Alsana, our eating disorder treatment center, just posted this on LinkedIn. Have you lost weight? Is not a compliment.
Right. Well, because sometimes people lose weight because they have an eating disorder.
Exactly.
I remember I worked in the psychiatric ward at College Hospital when I was in school.
Uh-huh.
And there were a lot of people that had eating disorders that would come in that were on the verge of death mm-hmm. because they were so starved or out of control with their eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And I remember one woman that I met that was of normal weight. And then she came back in a few months later and she'd probably lost 20 pounds and everybody was celebrating her weight loss. And I kept looking at her when people were saying this to her. She was so disturbed because she was starving herself.
Oh.
And on the verge of death, but everybody was praising her for...
Horrible. Yeah.
And this is in a psychiatric hospital where people you would think would know better, because I'm talking about the staff here, not the
the
other patients. Mm-hmm. I don't think that people really understood how much they were causing this young woman harm at the time. Because I don't think we really understand, like
and
you
said.
And not
every person who is overweight is unhealthy. Right. I have a client who weighs a lot and wants to lose weight. However, she is fit. She goes hiking a Rattlesnake Canyon. She is healthy. She has no diabetes, nothing. So we have this bias that if you're at a certain weight, you must be unhappy with it.
Right.
Right? I noticed this when my friends say, oh, so-and-so would be a good candidate for your program. I said, don't say that.
To the person?
To me.
Oh, to you.
To me.
Oh,
thinking
okay.
that, oh, so-and-so should be talking to you, but what if that person is happy with their weight?
Well, I mean, of course, it has to get down to how the person feels about themselves, as
yes.
we were saying before.
So befriending the body, and I often say, like, sign a peace treaty with your body, and you can also forgive yourself and say, you know, for 30 years, that's all I knew how to do is get through life by eating emotionally. Mm. I have a lot of compassion for that.
Sure.
Behavior always makes sense. We're not crazy for doing things that may be harmful. That's all we knew at the time.
Right. So again, part of what you're saying, I've talked a lot about on the podcast because I don't see people's symptoms as a sign of pathology.
Yes.
I think that a person's psychological symptoms are a form of communication.
Yes.
And that is a huge departure from how most of my colleagues look at therapy and people's lives. I mean, I know that in order for me to pass my licensing exam, I had to diagnose what was wrong with people, come up with a treatment plan in order to cure whatever it was ailing them, and then measure the success of the treatment based on whether the person's symptoms were resolved. And it was all about agreeing with people who already felt really bad about themselves, that there was something wrong with them.
I know.
And that's really offensive to me. I really, really dislike that idea.
I appreciate that. That's why I have the strength-based approach, you know. And, I appreciate you saying that.
It's really important in my mind because I get that it's not healthy to be overweight. But if you just focus on helping the person lose weight, it's not going to resolve anything, and diets will always fail because you're not dealing with...
Always, and there's so much research. I gave several presentations at psychiatric grant rounds at Cottage. I mean, there's so much research saying diets do not work, and they are harmful.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, I just gave a presentation to a physician in Glendale via Zoom about my program.
Okay.
And he said, how do you measure success? How much weight do people lose? And I said, well, hold on a second. You know, weight loss is a beneficial side effect.
Right.
My goal for my clients is to create a lighter existence emotionally and physically.
Right.
And so the core treatment is really about healing what needs to be healed deep, deep, deep inside. And like you said, that takes courage, patience, and trust.
Right, but that's contrary to the medical model of how what percentage of weight do people lose if they do your program. I mean, that's exactly what I would expect from you know, a physician who treats people's symptoms and is trying to help them resolve their symptoms without any sort of idea that maybe there's...
They don't know how.
Right.
And I recently joined, just to reach out to more physicians to educate them, I joined the Obesity Medicine Association and submitted a presentation proposal to a conference in Colorado. And I see the posts on LinkedIn. It's all about injections and this and this and this. And my program is non-prescription model. You know, it's...
Right.
It's, and I want to write a scholarly article on this.
Okay.
Because everything else is just skin deep, in my opinion.
Right.
We just look under the hood, but we don't really go to the core issue.
Well, you mentioned just briefly that there's a new drug that's come on the scene that everybody is raving about. It's a diabetic, a drug for diabetes, but it has
Ozempic, and it has beneficial side effects. It has weight loss effects, and I read an article this morning that patients lost 5% of their body weight, and I looked at, like, 5% of 265 pounds is 13 pounds or something.
Right.
And when they stop using the drug, well, they're back where they were.
Does the weight come right back?
I don't want to speak to it without having data.
Right.
But I would assume yes. I have talked to cottage hospitals by bariatric surgery patients.
Okay.
And what they experience after this pretty dramatic surgery, which can be life-saving because people really lose a lot of weight, but it creates this void and the need for other addictions, I heard from the practitioners. So okay. Anything that's too drastic worries me.
Right.
I'm not saying don't do it if it saves your life. I would never say that to somebody.
Right.
But if you want to make sure this is a lifelong learning experience, then I invite these clients to work with me. Because I always say what you learn with me, you cannot unlearn, and I mean that.
Okay.
It may take a while.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It took me years.
Well, because you're changing your whole relationship with yourself as opposed to just changing your behavior.
Well said.
Which is really important. And that's not something that, I mean, on off topic slightly, now psychedelic drugs are the new vogue, and that, all you got to do is a few journeys with psychedelic drugs.
Half an hour and you're done.
Right? And that's going to cure what ails you. And I just feel so bad that people, I mean, not that those things are not helpful, because I do have clients that have been hugely positively impacted by microdosing and that sort of thing. But that's long-term. That's not like a weekend where you solve all of
your issues. I don't believe in quick fixes or quick healing, instant healing. I don't believe in it because it was a lot of inner work and years of counseling with my therapist to heal my own trauma.
Okay. So you know how hard it is.
It's hard,
how long
but it's
it takes.
So worth it.
Well,
and,
yes.
I cannot imagine, well, I know how my cousins turned out in Germany. They both have severe psychological disorders. They never got therapy. They chose not to. They never took any meds to heal their depression. So that was my route.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you find people in Santa Barbara much more open to the idea that it's not just symptomatic treatment, but you have to deal with what is underlying your behavior.
Yes.
Because in other parts of the country, I'm not sure that it's as widely accepted that.
Yeah, I gave a talk to a doctor in Florida, interestingly enough, and I said, I'll sponsor the food for your staff. Well, they ordered Olive Garden, really heavy stuff. And the doctor wasn't able to activate her camera on Zoom for some reason. So I don't want to assume, but
I'm sorry to laugh.
I know.
It's like,
it's interesting. And when she asked me, she didn't ask a lot of questions. She was more, interesting. And it was almost like a brand new concept, healing.
Well, I think it is.
Healing the mother wound. If somebody asked me, Petra, what do you do? I would say I help heal the mother wound. Now that deserves an explanation, but in a nutshell, that's what I do.
And why exclude the father wound?
Yeah, good question. I have to think about that.
I only ask because I'm a dad.
No, I think I need to broaden that, and maybe because the mother with the breast and the nurturing and that connection, I keep saying mother wound, but I'll rethink it.
I'm only asking because I've done tons of therapy myself in order to be able to put one foot in front of the other especially in my 20s and early 30s. It was shared equally between my parents in terms of the trauma that I encountered.
Yes, and how could I word it if I don't say heal the mother wound, heal?
I guess it's a parental wound. I don't
parental
know.
Parental wound. Thank you.
I started taking care of my mom's pain in utero. And I have really clear.
Me too.
I have really clear memories of taking in her pain during gestation and having it poison me, and then I was born allergic to her milk, and I almost died because nobody could figure out why I couldn't digest. And it took months to be able to figure out how to feed me.
That's profound.
So that was part of my relationship with my mom. But my dad always weighed about 50 pounds. More than he should have.
Uh-huh.
So he always had a gigantic belly. And I grew up with my mom, telling him what a fat pig he was and him telling my mom how stupid she was. And that was the dance that they did. But my mom would go to the store to buy the food.
Yes.
It wasn't my dad. And yeah. She would buy everything that he couldn't resist.
Yes.
Because in her mind, keeping him fat would keep him from leaving her. So they had this incredibly awful dance that they did with each other until I was in my 20s and they finally got divorced. But it was really sad to watch both of them in action. Mm-hmm. And it was a parental wound, I guess.
Yeah, I like that parental wound. And in my case, my mom was so cut off from her own emotions because of what happened in the war.
Yeah.
And my father was a very loving dad, but didn't offer the warrior part, like the protective part.
Right.
And my mother, they didn't have a healthy relationship and she wouldn't leave him. So I grew up basically raising myself.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people in our generation had that experience. Certainly emotional connection was not a huge part of the culture. I mean, I'm a couple of years older than you, but still. They were too busy trying to earn a living and live in the world during that period of time.
Yes.
And kids were not really looked at as being something you had to pay a whole lot of attention to.
You know, it's interesting how we're sitting here. We're both helping people heal and how they say we're wounded healers. But I want to add to that as we're speaking. I'm thinking this right now. I'm no longer wounded. I feel like I have healed my wound majorly.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to just rethink this wounded healer concept.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the reasons I'm doing my podcast is because I felt like I couldn't help enough people to satisfy my need to be of service because I can only see a certain number of people in the course of my day.
And may I add right now that if somebody is interested in working with me, I offer an initial consultation that is free of charge.
Oh, okay.
To see if we're a good match for this deep dive.
Oh, that's a great idea. I actually we still have some time here, but I was going to ask you at the end of the podcast to make sure that people would know how to contact you and how contacting you would work and all so on and so forth. We can do that now if you want to.
Okay, well, I started talking about it.
Yeah, sure.
I do this for two reasons. First, I want to make sure I can help.
Okay.
If I feel I'm not the right therapist, I refer them out.
Okay.
To others.
But again, I want you to say the name of your your business.
So my business is the Mindful Eating Institute.
Okay, and that's in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
And how do people reach you if they want to reach you?
They can go on the website, and I have a thing that pops up that takes them to my calendar. They can schedule an initial consultation.
How do they find your website? Is it the same name as your business?
So it's Mindful Eating Institute.
And that's your website, like .com?
.net.
.net.
It's mindfuleatinginstitute.net. Okay. Or they can call or text me at 805-722-7400. I'll say that again.
Please.
805-722-7400.
And the initial contact is free of charge to make sure that that they're come to the right place and you have the ability. And what if somebody's living in a different community? Do you have people that you sort of...
I do telehealth.
Yeah?
I Zoom with my clients that don't live in Santa Barbara.
Oh, good.
And that
okay.
works really well, too.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, face-to-face is beautiful. So I gave up my office during COVID, and what I do now, I do either house calls or Zoom.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. So geography is not an impediment to working with you.
Say that again.
Geography is
geography.
Not,
no. Yeah. Nationwide, I can speak German too if somebody.
Oh, okay. No, that helps. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people in the world and in the United States who speak German for sure.
And I want to give listeners hope. I encourage a lot of hopelessness when clients first call me, like, "Oh God, I'll always be fat. Will I ever heal this?" Yes, you can.
Okay.
100. I don't want to give guarantees, but yes, I believe. You can.
Right.
It's a very important message.
Well, you know, I agree with your philosophy because I think that if you're not shaming people by agreeing with them that there's something wrong with them and you're helping them understand that their behavior is actually a normal response to overwhelming feelings that are really hard for people to cope with, that's really different than telling them that they have a disorder or that there's something wrong with them.
I don't like the labeling. I don't like clinical diagnoses.
Right.
We were all trained in using the DSM-4 or 5. And yes, they're guidelines. However, each person is unique.
Right.
And I cannot label who's sitting in front of me.
Right.
And I have a gift which I call being so intuitive and empathetic that I really sometimes, I mean, it doesn't sound like I don't want to say I'm psychic, but I get good insights during the process of what may serve somebody well.
Okay. Well, again, you're preaching to the choir because I've done a lot of episodes about intuitive connection as a crucial ingredient in both living your life and in healing, especially.
Yes.
So part of what I do a lot with people is teach them how to trust what they know.
Yes.
And really tune into that instead of being externally centered, which most of us are taught to be. I'm not asking people to become self-centered because that's obnoxious, but being centered in yourself is a really important concept that I really believe in. And it sounds like that's what you're asking people to do also is to learn how to really be connected to their center so that they can feel and know who
being
they really
connected,
are.
I always say my prescription for wellness is to love yourself deeply, to honor your boundaries and energy levels, to speak your truth from the heart, and to be you unapologetically.
Right.
So self-care is not just getting our nails done, our hair done, or being at this healthy weight. It's saying no when you mean no.
Right.
Especially when you never had the power or the right to say no.
Right.
No, thank you. I teach my clients to speak their truth, and it takes courage. I know this. I have to put on my warrior cape when I have to speak my truth, and I'm shaking in my boots when I do it, and it's always worth it.
Right.
I owe this to my inner little girl.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, and especially because when you're experiencing trauma, the most common reaction is to freeze.
Yes.
And what people tell me all the time is how badly they feel that they didn't fight or run when they were being brutalized in some fashion. And it's normal human reaction to freeze when you're being when your life is being threatened
100%.
Or when you feel overwhelmed. And it's that's a huge relief to people to understand that that you don't really have a choice to run away from being attacked, that your body's going to take over.
Yes.
And especially because there's actually research that I've and you know studies I've seen about animals that are being preyed upon and they all of a sudden drop dead and appear to be dead and whoever's attacking them walks away because they don't eat something
survival
they don't kill
mechanism, yes,
right 100%. So then the animal wakes up, looks around and goes, I can't believe I'm around, and then wanders away in a healthy way.
Yes.
So it's a mammalian response to freeze. And so again, just another example of how it's teaching people how to speak up helps them heal their trauma.
Yes, and tapping into the potential of being empowered, which seems so foreign to some.
Right.
I didn't know how to do that for many, many years.
Right.
I also, we have a few minutes, right, experience when clients work with me after 3 months, they haven't lost any weight yet, Petra, but I feel so much better, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that they stop stressing about what this, I still honor a client's desire and wish to feel lighter. I get it, if that's important to them.
Sure.
But it's an inside-out approach. I feel let's do the inner work first, the rest will follow.
Okay. So we have about 5 minutes left. What have I forgotten to ask you about that's important? That you want to mention? Because I know you have lots of insight and experience.
Yeah, what do I want to share?
Because you've been very candid about what you're doing and how you do it. Maybe you've shared everything. I don't know, but...
I look at your heart that's hanging on the wall and such a powerful and important question to ask yourself. What is my heart hungry for? That can relate to work, to relationships, to creative expression, to many things. The heart knows the way.
Okay.
They now refer to our heart as the second brain. So I teach my clients, trust your gut, trust your heart. It's all there. You know what you need. And I truly believe every client that sits in the chair in front of us, Dana, knows what they need. We just help them uncover that.
Can you give me some examples of things that people didn't really understand that they were hungry for, that they were substituting food for?
So I know we're running out of time. Just one quick example comes to mind. A young woman who came to me, she was born and raised in Brazil, was very overweight, and married a man, moved to America. and worked in a pretty mindless job doing some accounting. And when I asked the question, if a fairy came in right now and granted you a wish, she said, oh, I would be back on stage.
Really?
She was an actress.
Really?
Yes.
That's a huge...
Huge. Withering away as an accountant and eating her pain and her suffering. I mean, all that creative energy was just forced down. And my God, my heart opened for her. I'm like, wow, you need to be back on stage.
That's amazing. That's a really distinct difference between how she was living and what she was really hungry for.
Yes.
And was this person able to kind of get to a place where she allowed that for herself?
Over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't expect her to walk out the door. And
some people get scared. You know, if I present a solution that is radical, like, wow, I don't know if I can do that.
Okay.
So.
Is it more of a fear of failure or a fear of success?
I don't know.
You're
that
not sure.
Depends. Okay. Yeah.
Because a lot of times people don't really understand that a fear of success is as potent as a fear of failure. Because
well, that's worth an exploration. I would say let's sit with it.
Yeah.
Let's meditate on it.
Right. Do you meditate with people in your office sometimes? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't have an office, but when I meet with them in person, I bring my little meditation chime and we drop into a mindfulness meditation just to start the session by downshifting and down-dialing the energy and just dropping into the present moment.
Okay.
And I invite all my clients to implement meditation into their lives. And I wish every doctor
could do the
say
same
to you when you come in as a patient, are you meditating? Oh,
okay.
If not, I want you to start.
Well, it sounds like you have a very strong spiritual component that is part of how you do your thing.
Yes.
Do people accept the spiritual part of things?
I keep it so light and neutral.
Yeah.
I have clients who are Christians, and I work with that concept when they said, hey, God, do you want some ice cream with me right now?
I
just understand it's just a different form of expression.
Right.
And I have a question in my questionnaire, which is, are you connected spiritually? It's important to understand if a client has access to that, but if not, that's okay too.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And again, anything else?
I'm grateful for the opportunity to share my calling. And I would love to help more people heal their parental wound.
Right.
So thank you, Dana. That's
it's my pleasure.
Like to say.
You are a very inspirational. It's so nice to meet someone who is not pathologizing people that are trying to lose weight.
Mm.
Because everything that we read has to do with reinforcing their shame and, using drugs as an example, which, I mean, when I was reading about the side effects of that new injectable drug, oh my God, like half the people that take it.
But it's so seductive and it's like, this will help me get there.
Yes.
And I want people to understand there is another way. That is the main message. There is another way.
Right. Well, and especially because this fad will pass, just like all the other ones have, and people will still find themselves in the same boat because if you don't deal with the underlying issues, it's really, really hard to change the way you feel about yourself.
You have to be ready and open.
Yes.
And like I said, I make people feel safe because you need to feel safe in order to take that deep dive.
Right. Somebody the other day said to me, you know, Dana, you're an elbow therapist. So I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you know, when you get a massage and sometimes they use your elbow to break up a knot.
Oh, that's
sometimes when I'm talking to you, you bring the elbow in. I said, well, I'm not trying to do it on purpose. And it was a compliment, actually, that the person was saying, you know.
For release, you bring in the elbow.
Yeah, I really like the idea
that you'll
go as far as you need to go to help me deal with what I need to and not sort of back away from the scary, painful issues.
Yes.
Because that serves no purpose.
Well, I'm glad you're there to help people heal their trauma.
Well, you as well. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you.
And again, I'm hoping that people will contact you and get the help they're looking for.
I'm here.
So thank you.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.